Welcome to Empathy and Action. I'm your host, Jennifer Rogers Brown. Empathy and Action is a podcast by Rural and Migrant Ministry as part of our Journey of Empathy caravan to save New York's rural economy. In this podcast series, we will hear stories from the past and present. These stories hold up the resilience, struggles, and positive impact of rural communities and immigrants in New York State. In this episode of the series, we look to the past for inspiration as we confront the struggles of today. Our guests will talk about what stories from the past, fiction or nonfiction, have impacted their thinking. They will also talk about historical moments of activism for immigrant and worker rights.
Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. You were born to manifest the glory that is within us. And as we let our light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others.
You just listened to A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson, read by Janine Otis. Joining me for this first segment is Reverend Miguel Escobar, deacon at San Andres Episcopal Church, and Reverend Jane Gold, RMM's theologian in residence. Thank you both for being here. As a reminder, a key focus for RMM's caravan is empathy. How does learning about the past help us build empathy as we deal with this harsh political climate? Let's go to you first, Reverend Gold.
So, I have to confess that even though I have spent my adult life working as clergy within the Episcopal Church and in the arena of faith-based community organizing, my first training was as a historian. And in the fall post-election in 2016, one of my colleagues in community organizing, Alexandra Pinheiro Shields, gave me Tim Snyder's book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. And what Snyder does is look at the challenges to freedom and democracy that evolved over the 1930s that allowed for the rise of fascism in Europe, really everywhere, but particularly in Germany, Italy, and Spain. And what he raises are parallels to what he saw beginning to happen in the US in terms of our public institutions and our systems of governance. And, I read the book with interest there, underlining and starring. But pandemic hit, life went on. And I think most of us didn't take as seriously as we might the challenges. And now we find ourselves in a world that, for me, as one who grew up in Washington, D.C., in the era of Watergate, I know well political corruption and political corruption motivated by a desire for personal power. What we're seeing now is something that I think is of quite a different nature, which is a destruction of our institutions and our way of understanding ourselves as a nation in which we strive to become what frankly, the founding fathers didn't really imagine, but what their language allows, which is a country in which all people are valued and everyone thrives. But the problem, I think, in the 30s in Europe was that most people weren't strong supporters of fascism. They simply went on about their lives because they weren't being touched. And the safest thing to do with the culture of fear that was created by the sort of quasi-military police institutions of the SS and other force, the brown shirts, what got created was this culture of fear. And so people just kept their heads down and said, so long as I don't sort of draw anyone's attention, I'll be fine. And I think my concern in this country is that our polls tell us right now, most people are not in support of what the administration is doing, but they also aren't engaged. They're figuring, not touching me. I'm just going to keep my head down. I'm going to be okay. And, life's going to go on. And I think the caravan of empathy is intended to awaken all of us to the story of the people who are already being hurt by the decisions and policies and programs and budgets of our country right now, to tell those stories, because if we don't awaken empathy and a sense of connection with those who are in pain, we will let ourselves slide into being something that we never imagined. A country in which human life doesn't matter, where people can't imagine opportunity, and where it is compliance and fear-driven obedience in which we sacrifice those who might be perceived in some way as different, whether they be people of color, immigrants, LGBTQ. And we need to hear those stories now. We need to bring ourselves together as a people who really do care about humanity.
Thank you, Reverend Gold. Yes, stories are indeed very powerful. Reverend Escobar, what are you thinking about this?
Great, yeah. This question really prompted me to start reflecting on what I did in the immediate kind of aftermath of the November election and how I sort of resourced myself during that period. I think, like many people, there was a New York Times article about this, but like many people, I took a break from the news. I just took a long break, since returned, of course. But and during that time, I just found myself trying to read and orient myself to this new stage. And one of the things I read was some fiction and also history. In terms of fiction, I reread Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn so that I could read James by Percival Everett. And I have to say that in some ways was one of the most helpful things for me in terms of orienting myself again to this period, because it reminded me that, in the United States, we have a very, very long period of our history of utter dehumanization of labor, particularly. The whole story takes place, obviously, in the context of slavery. And the structure of racist structure of whiteness, which upheld that. And yet it's also a story in many respects of hope and resilience. There are these key moments where Huck, the protagonist, realizes that to do the right thing, he has to do the illegal thing. To do the moral thing, he has to go against everything that he's hearing from church leaders, of the church leaders of his day. And so it's just this powerful reminder for me that not that we've been here before, this is different, obviously, but that we have been, as a country, steeped in dehumanization, steeped in racial structures that allow for that, and that there are people and movements that have, tried to follow the North Star in a time in which everything seems to be reversed, when good is bad and bad is good, and that it does feel like where we are at this moment, and just as Jane was saying, where we're quickly returning to this place where, any form of moral action feels like resistance and is going to be potentially categorized as resistance in terms of legal structures. So I found that really helpful, just reading those two. And then the second thing I found really helpful in terms of history, more perhaps pertinent to the issues of immigration and refugees, was a book called Everyone Who Is Gone Is Here by Jonathan Blitzer. And it's the subtitle is The United States, Central America, and the Making of a Crisis. And what it does is it tries, tries to take a panoramic view of the United States' involvement in Latin America since about the 1970s, and how this story is what is fueling the current immigration issues and the United States' response to that, that are affecting so many communities, including people within the community that I serve in. To understand why there's so many folks from the Dominican Republic or Venezuela, El Salvador, really, really helps. You really kind of need to hear this larger story of how the U.S. was involved in the 1970s and 80s and beyond, and then the categories of sort of asylum seeking and refugee status. And I think that really, really helps broaden the picture from just this question of illegal versus not, illegal versus not. I think we have to, at least internally, be grounded in that larger story of people and of the complicated history as well.
You are making me think about how much misinformation and disinformation exists out there about the history around immigration. The realities of that history can be found in the stories passed down over time, and some have been thankfully archived. However, many of these stories are under threat or even being removed as a public resource.
For me, and I think it is one of the reasons that I see being a historian and being a priest and preacher and theologian all kind of fit together, is that I think story is how we make meaning. And when we make it too dangerous for people to share their stories, and that, then we lose part of our identity as a people. And I think historically, what is true about most protest, successful sort of social protest movements is that they allowed people whose stories had been silenced or obliterated to come together and realize their shared narrative. And so it's sort of moving folks from, as community organizer Marshall Gans would say, from the story of self to the story of us to the story of now. And now being, what is the actionable moment? But we have to know our stories. We have to be able to listen to the stories of those closest to the pain. And already we're seeing many folks whose own documentation status may not be sort of fully in line with what Homeland Security would like, or someone in their family, they're just in a mixed system. We see them staying away from meetings, not joining groups, not seeking care, whether healthcare, not education, because they're fearful. And I think we have to be able to create spaces of resilience and hope where people can tell their story and understand that their story is the story of so many. And I think it's that power of community moving through story that will give us the strength to speak and tell the stories that need to be heard.
Thank you for that. Any concluding remarks, Reverend Escobar?
Yeah, I mean, just to, I think, affirm what Jane just said about the power of story. I'm also clergy, quickly about to become a priest, and part of the reason why I am is because I believe that it's important to tell this story year in and year out of Jesus, who lived, and the early Christians who lived under a persecuting empire, and who told their own story over and over again of how life can overcome even the most dangerous and death dealing circumstances. And that speaks to, I think, the power of art, the power of music, the power of poetry, which I think RMM does really good job of soliciting and showing the art and voices and music of the people who are directly impacted by these issues. So rural migrants. And to the extent that we can continue to uphold those stories, the complicated stories, because they are more complicated than our political partisanship oftentimes frames. And I think just continue to try to put those forward, because I think that will tell a more complex story for people of what is happening and what has been happening for a very long time. When I speak with congregations, one of the things I always sort of do is introduce myself. I say, my mother was born in Mexico. I'm sort of first generation, but I would say kind of 1.5, because my mother came here when she was very young in the United States. But even that story is much, much more complicated. And it speaks to the border realities that my grandmother was born in Texas, but my mother was born in Mexico. There was no real border for a very long time, really until almost the Clinton administration. There was, broad flow back and forth. My father was born in a part of Texas that used to be Mexico. They joked that the line crossed them, So when you start to actually hear stories from migrants and immigrants and of what they were fleeing, the way that asylum categories were suddenly reduced over the past 10 years, suddenly a much, much more complex story about what has been happening in this country and beyond emerges. And I think it's really hard. The landscape is harder to tell those stories right now, but that makes it even more important. And so just to kind of applaud RMM for continuing to solicit those stories and to try to get those out there as much as possible.
What a thought-provoking conversation. Thank you both for your time.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah.
Of each other.
Joining me today for this segment is David Schilling, a senior advisor at the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. In addition to his years of work in international human rights, he worked closely with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta during their fight for farm worker rights. He's also a clergy member for the United Methodist Church. Thank you for joining me today, David. How are you doing today?
Well, it's an honor and privilege to talk with you. It's a little warm, but I think we all need to get up and energized and get the blood flowing because all the challenges that we seek. But I've always been a strong supporter of the Rural and Migrant Ministry, which is doing some great work.
Well, thank you. And I agree. As you know, we have RMM's Caravan for Empathy and in support of New York's rural economy and immigrants. And with that in mind, I know you have lots of stories. And I'm wondering what stories of immigrant farm labor or rurality have shaped your thinking today.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that I was really, really, really fortunate to be born into the family that I was, because my father, who became a Methodist minister, he was in a farm, small community in Wisconsin, and my mother in Knoll Shore, Nova Scotia, she was a teacher. They ended up meeting in Pyongyang, Korea in 1937, teaching at this school, primarily of missionary children and others, and then got married, which I'm so happy they did, in 1940, came back to Wisconsin. So I think my mindset has always been, even though growing up in small town Wisconsin, it was, you know, the global aspect that I got very early because of their Korea experience. So I had this feeling like, you know, if there was a Korean within 500 mile radius of our home in Wisconsin, they would be there. So being in the small towns, I grew up in a more global context. And my mother was really a social justice activist and racial justice. So it really helped to kind of shape where I would be going and what kinds of things I'd be doing in called a ministry. So, I mean, in a way, started early with a whole number of movements, the anti-war movement during the Vietnam, the civil rights movement, and then I graduated from Union Seminary in Columbia in 1970, went to California and was living in Milpitas, California. And it was like probably 10 miles from where Cesar Chavez had lived for a very, very long time. Of course, he grew up, you know, in Arizona and became a farm worker himself at 11. So he you know, amazing person. So I've always been fortunate to connect and also be inspired by people that really have helped guide the first. It was, you know, those that are most exploited, general category. But then California, 1970, it was the farm workers, and they had struggled for so long, you know, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, lots of good organizers, but the big growers, and these are like multinational companies, they're not small farms, like in the San Joaquin Valley down to Coachella. It was like there was always a collusion between the big companies going to the courts, make it an illegal for picketing and for a strike. And then the police would come in and they would arrest. So that was the context in which when we moved to California from New York to California, and I'd met some farm workers in 1967 who set up the first boycott of the United Farm Workers. Because 40s, 50s, 60s, as I said, you know, even some very good organizing, and it's so hard for workers to put their life and their family and the income on the line to strike. But it was really then that the unique kind of leadership of Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta was at play, because they realized they were always going to lose if they just stayed in the valley. But all of a sudden, boycott offices around the country, and many Americans stopped purchasing California table grapes. So that's where I come in 1970, and within about 3-4 months, I was recruited to participate in and lead this Santa Clara County Council of Churches, you know, farmworker justice. And then, you know, it went to Northern California. So I think some of the stories that stick with me, you know, in those years, the real success of Cesar, Dolores, and many, many others in building this union under very difficult circumstances. But by 73, the growers said, no, we don't want to go back to the UFW. They're asking too much. They approached the Teamsters Union to sign what we call a sweetheart contract, which is, you know, they didn't have any relationship with the farm workers, but the growers could say, we have a union. And at that point where I had helped to get, you know, was chair of this National Farm Worker Ministry, Justice Working Group in the Bay Area, to get faith leaders to support the UFW strategies. And in this case, it started in Coachella, went all the way up the valley, because workers then would go out on strike in 73, the summer of 73. And then it was so impactful for me, because it wasn't just, you know, trying to get people there, but going to Coachella and then up the valley and ending up with 2 weeks in jail in Fresno County with farm workers. And it was revelational. I mean, it was, you know, we always would go to the valley, but it'd be like a weekend. And we had an opportunity to really engage and learn about the life of young farm workers. So I think once you get that proximity with people, you can't turn away. So it deepened my sort of commitment to this kind of work. And I was also obviously still a United Methodist clergy in a small church, and, you know, brought the, in the end, they were very supportive. But there's no way that once you see the conditions in the fields, once you see people that are working so hard and are struggling to put food on the table when they're making, you know, it possible for all of us to have food on our table, there's no way that you can sort of turn back. And I think that had, it really shaped me tremendously.
It's really interesting that you say that it is so important for us to bear witness to see what's happening. And it's amazing that you were there and was so, I can see that connection, that this helped inform your thinking and as a call to action for others to be there and to be in those spaces, be uncomfortable even.
Yeah. Would you say?
Yeah. Oh yeah, exactly. I mean, cause you know, we had, when we were arrested, Cesar had called and said, you know, farm workers had been on strike. They were arrested in Fresno County Jail, and some of them were being beaten. And he always felt like if you have, you know, priests and nuns and religious on the picket lines, there may be less violence against workers. And I think to some degree that helped, although, you know, at any rate, I think felt like we could play a role and, you know, get arrested, but stay for the 2 weeks until we were released as a result. With the United Farm Workers, they were, in part, it was that we're doing such important work and really getting workers to, you know, express their agency, and also recognizing that the faith community can play a huge role. So one of the things that I think needs to be written more is Chris Hartmeyer, who graduated in 62 from Union Seminary, had other plans, but then comes to California as the executive director of the California Migrant Ministry. And at that point, in 62, it was like a social service organization, and it had Bibles given to, you know, the camps. You know, it was, I mean, trying to do good, but it missed the systemic issues. So Chris meets Dolores and Cesar, and they worked together for years and years and years. And he was so instrumental in framing the plight of farm workers and why it's so important to establish and ways to really support their strategies, not our strategies, but their strategies. And I think that's where I really learned the power of the faith community in conjunction with, you know, workers themselves, of course, in the union and labor and other supporters that come in. So it's so critical. But I look at the rural and migrant ministry as that kind of model where faith leaders are sort of, you know, in at the engine, but the workers and unions and a lot of community people are so essential if there's going to be any change. But we can't underestimate or back away as faith communities from the hard issues of justice when it's so patently plain that we're needed. So I do think that this caravan has a tremendous potential to make the public aware of what's taking place. And let's face it, the taking people off the street and exporting them to another country is so unconscionable morally, but it also hurts the economy. Because, you know, there are estimates that if, as you know, like in 2023, my understanding is that undocumented workers paid taxes, federal, state, local taxes, well over $3 to $4 billion. And then if you look at the families, their impact on the total economy, it's what it could be, $40 billion in the United States. And of course in New York it's also this case. So I think there's a strong purpose in face-to-face plus social media and not giving up our sense of agency. Because right now I talk to so many people that they just feel powerless. So that kind of organizing can bring understanding and support and trust and community that leads, I think, to the kind of justice that we need in this economy as well as around the world.
Thank you, David. We'll end it there on that very empowering note, and I appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I look forward to continuing working with the organization.
As David Schilling said, we can't give up even when the struggle goes on for decades. Alan Lubin is a longtime RMM board member and previous NYSET executive vice president. He shared with me a blog he wrote in 2007 about his visit to the U.S.-Mexico border with the Labor Religion Coalition. It was a border witness delegation. I will read to you part of the first section of his blog where he documented what he saw when he first visited several border crossings. Remember, this was in 2007. I share this as an example of how labor and religion can work together and the power of witnessing, documenting, and sharing stories. Wednesday, October 31st, 6 p.m. I arrived in El Paso yesterday evening. The amazing thing about this trip is you have to not consider it a trip to Mexico, but rather a trip to a border, not the country of Mexico or even America. When you ask people what a border is, you almost get a negative response. It's to keep people out, to separate or protect, but it's never a positive thing. Borders are really designed to impede and not include when they should really be almost a blending of cultures. El Paso is right in the middle of the 2,000-mile border between the two countries, right at the 1,000-mile mark. We're learning that the issue here is how to keep people out. Today we were at a part of the border that did not have a fence, and we stepped over the quote-unquote border. It was interesting to think that when we stepped back into the U.S., we were committing the same crime these Mexicans do, yet we look at them as criminals. We don't do this in Canada because we're not as afraid. Their skin is not as dark. It makes me think of America's reaction to the Berlin Wall. The Russians in charge of East Berlin wanted this separation. In this situation, America wants to separate more so than Mexico. And now we are starting to construct a 2,000-mile wall ourselves. A tale of two cities. Today we spoke to different workers and we spent a great deal of time at three different parts of the border. At one point, we climbed high above the city, and looking down, we could not tell where one city ended and the other began. But it becomes quite obvious who are the haves and the have-nots. If you happen to be born on this side of the fence, you can get a good job, own a home, and your kids can go to school. If you happen to be born on the other side, you have nothing. Most people coming here illegally are coming for a chance for economic security for their families. 99% are coming because they cannot feed their family, because they cannot house their family. In El Paso, everybody lives in a home. In Juarez, many people live in houses constructed of wooden pallets, cardboard, and for those in better shape, cinder blocks. Where we have a federal minimum wage of $7.15 an hour, the minimum wage in Juarez is $5 a day. Back at the third border crossing we visited, which was in a park, there was no fence. There were, however, plenty of cameras watching everybody. It reminded me of East Berlin when I visited Alexander Plaza. There were no benches or trees, but there were cameras to make sure people didn't congregate. At the border today, there was one tree, no benches, but there were three cameras to make sure we did not step over the border. If you visit Berlin today and go to Alexander Plaza, there are restaurants, businesses, and hundreds of people congregating and shopping. For me, one question remains. When will we be able to visit the park I saw today and see the same thing, Americans and Mexicans shopping, talking, and eating together? That ends the blog post by Alan Lubin. Thank you, Alan, for sharing this blog post with us. As we are all witnesses to what is happening right now, consider the stories that you will be telling the next generation and the generation after that. What are you collecting? What are you writing down and documenting? How can you bear witness and help the next generation be even more educated around these issues? Thank you for joining us today for RMM's Empathy and Action. This is a podcast series as part of our Journey of Empathy caravan to save New York's rural economy. Thank you to Alan Lubin and Reverends Jane Gold, Miguel Escobar, and David Schilling. Earlier on in the episode, you heard A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson, read by Janine Otis. You later heard In the Shelter of Each Other, sung by Kim and Reggie Harris. Both were taken from RMM's Voices of Hope concert CD in 2012. Intro and outro music by an anonymous youth activist. Please join us for the next episode, where we focus on the role of the arts in our rural communities, including the importance of immigrants within the arts and the way art can be used to build bridges, express ourselves, and act as a universal language. In solidarity, I'm Jennifer Rogers Brown.